And now it's recording. Okay, so this is the first recording with my brand new recorder. Hopefully the quality will be good. Hopefully it will last longer than the last one did. But, you know, we'll see. So we are in the discussion about the authorship of Mishlei and whether this is a book written by Jews, and is it a book with divine inspiration, right? Those are the questions that we were wrestling with. We saw the argument that yes, this is a book of special divine wisdom written by Shlomo, by King Solomon, and we saw the statements of the book itself that he is the author. We saw elements of the canonization discussion of what we do with the names in chapter 30 and 31 that seem to be names of other authors and ways to argue that they're actually Shlomo. That was a couple of weeks ago. Then we started last week on the view that no, this is actually a book of human wisdom. And we said that wouldn't mean that it's not valuable. We know that the Torah values wisdom from many sources. We talked about how Parshas Yisro, this coming week's Torah portion, highlights Yisro giving Moshe great advice that God actually ratifies. But we said we would still look at it differently if it's not Shlomo's wisdom, Shlomo being somebody who's supposed to be wiser than everybody, and his wisdom is supposed to be coming from God. And one piece of evidence that we brought to suggest that it's not Jewish authorship is the challenge to Shlomo as the author. A challenge which is not so much based on substantive evidence, as it is on Shlomo is just too legendary. Some do challenge Shlomo as the author based on particular themes within the book. We talked about the Isha Zara, the foreign woman, and whether that's a statement about intermarriage, the embodiment of wisdom as a woman, as a potential Greek idea. There are also some who try to date the book or locate the book based on its emphasis on agriculture or lending or whatever, but none of those really seem to militate against Shlomo's authorship. We did note Shlomo's relationship with Egypt, which we're going to come back to today. And more substantively, we talked about the attributions in chapter 30, 31 as being to people other than Shlomo potentially, who could have been people who were not Jewish. That was all in terms of the authorship of the book. I hope this is coming through clearly. On my computer, people are still jumping. I don't know. Okay, it's coming through clearly on your end. That's good. The other piece of the argument, well, pieces of the argument against Shlomo was that the content doesn't seem to be particularly Jewish or divine in many ways. And that's an argument that is brought to say, therefore, maybe this isn't from Shlomo. On the other hand, we saw there was plenty that was Jewish here, that was consistent with a Jewish source and a traditional Jewish source. The name of God that's used is the Shem HaMeforash, that four-letter Yud, Hey Vav, and Hey Name. It's a name that a Jewish author in particular would have used. The term Yirat Hashem, awe of God, shows up 15 times throughout the book. The idea in the book that wisdom comes from God, these are all things that are consistent with it being a Jewish text in terms of its origins. We also talked about the similarity of the structure and content of Mishlei to what is called wisdom literature in Egypt and Mesopotamia, in other cultures that are around before, during, and after the time of Shlomo. One thing that I actually wanted to correct, because I got confused last time by a note in a Victor Hurwitz, when I was talking about wisdom literature in Tanakh. So I blended that with wisdom, with the idea of Sifrei Emet, the books of Emet, meaning Iyov, Mishlei, Tehillim. And to make sure to state it more clearly this time, wisdom literature in Tanakh is generally understood to be three books that are in sequence in Ketuvim, Mishlei, Iyov, and Koheles. Those are the three. And then part of Tehillim is also included in wisdom literature. that was the that's just a corrective note from last time. And we said that the wisdom literature found in Tanakh is alleged to have certain differences from general wisdom literature. And I quoted Rabbi Chaim Angel on this point. It's also in the John Ruffel article. That in Egypt and Mesopotamia, wisdom is really for sages, whereas in Mishlei, it's meant to be for a broader audience. And Egypt doesn't see wisdom leading to righteousness. Mishlei has wisdom as an explanation for why we do mitzvot, and then wisdom tells us, go perform mitzvot. I'm going to be coming back to that point in a little bit. Finally, we talked about the section in the third part of Mishlei, commonly called the third part of Mishlei, that some scholars contend was ripped off of the wisdom of Amenemope or instruction of Amenemope from Egypt. And we brought John Ruffel's response, which I thought really did a very nice job of pointing out that the association, the commonalities of the wisdom are not surprising. Wisdom looks like wisdom across many cultures. But the idea that the text itself is drawing from the other is very hard to sustain. The parallels between the two are not actually parallel. They tend to be superficially parallel. And we gave a lot of examples. We're not going through all of that. Again, you can go back to the recording and get the full discussion. But what I wanted to do this time is to ask the question, let's take view number two. View number two, meaning the view that it's not Shlomo who wrote it. It's not divine. It's not necessarily Jewish in origin. Could a Jew accept that? If it were proved, if you were to find the book of Mishlei in Mesopotamia, in, an era 5,000 years before Shlomo, what would that do? Would that be the end of the world for us? And then I want to go on to a third view of how to understand the authorship. Yes, Susan?
I was wondering, if they canonized it, the people who canonized it must have done all this research as best as they could at the time.
Yeah.
So if it's already been canonized, why is it so important that we now find out why?
Right. So if you go back to the recording from last time, because I know you couldn't make it, you'll hear the discussion we had about the issues that came up in the canonization of Mishlei. It was not a slam dunk. And we did bring canonization as an argument for saying it's Jewish and considered holy, but we noted that there were challenges to it. For those who are in my other classes, you already know this, but for those who are only in the Tuesday afternoon one, my recorder broke after the last class, and I had to re-record the class. So if you go to listen to it, you get 45 minutes instead of an hour. So you can catch that recording. Okay. So could we accept an argument that the origin of this book is not a Jewish origin, that it's not Shlomo's divinely granted wisdom? So it's definitely hard to accept that the book is Egyptian. The idea of Amenemope, right, associating it with Egypt, is hard. On the one hand, and I mentioned this briefly in my introduction, the Egyptian link fits a certain picture of Shlomo, and certainly towards the end of his life. He marries the daughter of the Pharaoh, right? We had all these discussions about the fact that the Torah says specifically he's not allowed to marry an Egyptian before the third generation, and how Abarbanel tries to save what he did while others just say, yeah, it was wrong. But he marries the daughter of the Pharaoh. Remember that, and I gave you references in source number one on the sheet, but we're not going to spend time looking them up. But remember that he built the daughter of the Pharaoh a special palace in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, which earned him the ire of the people, that whole thing about filling in the Milo. We learned about it last year. And that actually ends up adding fuel to the revolt of Yerovam ben Nevat against Shlomo's son. We also know that the Pharaoh gives Shlomo a gift by conquering the city of Gezer and handing it to him. And we have Shlomo going to Egypt for horses. So Shlomo has Egyptian associations. And not only that, but Shlomo was identified with, criticized for, and punished for this association. So that, still in source number one, the references I gave you there, we find out that there is an enemy of Shlomo who takes refuge in Egypt. That is his incubator from which he will attack. We also find that in the next generation, Egypt's new king, Shishak, invades and takes shields that Shlomo left in the Beis HaMikdash. So Shlomo has a history with Egypt, and it's a problematic history with Egypt. But I don't think we can accept it for Mishlei, and this, I come back to the point that Susan raised, which is, the book is in Tanakh, and we wouldn't include ill-gotten gains, so to speak, in Tanakh, especially the way that Tanakh itself criticizes Shlomo for his Egypt association. You know, Tanakh itself says that was bad. So it's hard to think that the canonizers of Tanakh are going to include a book that flies in the face of the values that they themselves expressed. For the same reason, it's hard to accept that the entire book, I underline the word entire, would be secular wisdom. Remember that we already saw last week when we talked about the canonization, we said that the sages pushed to put in Geniza, away from people's eyes, books that they felt were actually secular. They said, that doesn't belong in Tanakh. And even stronger than that, take a look at source number two on your sheet. This is from the Gemara in Perek Chelek in Sanhedrin. Perek Chelek is either the last chapter or the next to last chapter of Sanhedrin, depending on which edition you're working with. And in it we get a Mishnah, in which Rabbi Akiva says, the Mishnah, let me just begin with the beginning of the Mishnah. In the beginning of the Mishnah we're told, all Israel gets a share in the next world. Everyone's happy. And then it says, and these are the people who don't. And it names names. And it names specific behaviors. And one of the things that you see there is Rabbi Akiva's comment. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Af HaKorei B'Sfarim HaChitzonim. Also, somebody who reads external books does not enter into the next world. What does that mean, external books? Tana, B'Sifrei Minim, books written by those who are heretics, attackers of Torah. The word min does not have a great translation. Rabbi Yosef Omer, B'Sefer Ben Sira Nami Aser LeMikri. And this is the key. Rabbi Yosef says, you're not allowed to read the book of Ben Sira. Now, we're going to talk about Ben Sira, not this week, hopefully next week. There's a lot to say about Ben Sira. But right now, what you need to know about the book of Ben Sira is that it is a basically, you know, I wouldn't use the word benign, but it's a book of proverbs and lessons that looks awfully similar to Mishlei. It exists. You can find it. Although, you know, Rabbi Yosef may not want you to read it. But the book is out there. You sometimes see it published with Sirah written S-I-R-A-C-H. Sirah. So Rabbi Yosef says the book of Ben Sira also may not be written. And then Abaye, student of Rabbi Yosef, challenged him and he said, why? Is it because of this statement in the book? Is it because of that statement in the book? And each statement, he says, no, this statement is fine. And in the end, Amar Rabbi Yosef concedes, and he says, "Mili ma'al yisad is be'darshin alohu." You're allowed to learn the good things that are found in Ben Sira. My point in bringing this is that if when you have a book that has some good things and some bad things, you're saying, "Hey, don't read this. At best, just read the good things." You're not going to include a book in Tanakh if you feel like it is an outside book. So while we do have a possible argument that the words of some non-Jewish sages were included in chapters 30 and 31, where we named them as authors, it's hard to see the whole book in that light. It's just it's difficult, just in terms of consistency with Tanakh and Jewish tradition. But I want to offer you a third view, because I think that this holds, I think it fits with a lot of what we've been saying in the first two views, and with some of the things that we know to be true about the nature of Tanakh. We have an idea, which shows up in a lot of different places, that Tanakh responds to the world around us. It isn't simply a text in a vacuum presenting Jewish ideas. It's actually a response to an environment in which those ideas live. So we see that regarding some of the mitzvos in the Torah, for example. The Rambam is well known for this. Take a look at source number 3. The Rambam expresses multiple ideas for why we bring karbanos. Right? Everybody wanted to know, historically, why in the world would we bring animal sacrifices? You've got, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the 16th century collects 14 different explanations / justifications for animal sacrifice. So this is one of the explanations which the Rambam brings in source number 3. Morah Nevuchim. He says, the Torah has told us that the Egyptians worshipped the constellation of the lamb, which was why they prohibited slaughtering sheep, and they abhorred herders of sheep, right? As the Torah tells us in the beginning of the book of Shmos and the end of Bereishis. And groups of the Sabaeans, the Yemenites, worshipped demons and thought they took the form of goats. And slaughtering cattle was abhorred by most idolaters, and they raised this species in great numbers. And so you find that people from India will not slaughter cattle even today, says the Rambam in the 12th century. So he says, sheep, goats, and cattle were worshipped in these other societies. And to eradicate these false views, he, God, commanded us to bring only these three species as animal sacrifices, so that the deed that they considered the ultimate rebellion would be used to draw closer to God and would be used to atone for sins. The idea of the karban is meant to flip idolatry on its head. What the Rambam is telling you is that karbanos, sacrifices, which are such a major thing in the Chumash, are a response to the world around us. Give you another example from the Rambam in source number 4 regarding the mitzvah of not cutting the corners of the hair of one's head or the corner of one's beard, right? Male haircut rules in the Torah. So a man is not supposed to get his haircut like this, straight around. Think like the mushroom cut, right? And nothing here and then just everything on top. Or to cut the peyot, the corners of the beard. Why is that? Says the Rambam, number 4. We have already explained in our great composition, the Mishnah Torah, that cutting the corner of the head and corner of the beard is prohibited because it is the grooming of idolatrous priests. It's what the priests for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, did. This is also the reason to prohibit shatnez, wearing wool and linen garments, because that was what their priests did. So the Torah is giving us a response to those things. One other example, which I used in a Parsha Shir some time back, and I think it came up also in one of our Tuesday afternoon classes some years ago, but I don't remember why. The law of Sota. The law of Sota, which says that in the event that a man suspects his wife of being intimate with a man who she was alone with, and he warns her about that, and she is alone with the guy again anyway, which is a violation of the Torah's law in general, this isolation, having nothing to do with the husband saying anything. But in that event, so she drinks water that has had God's name erased into it, and if anything bad happens, then miraculously, she will be punished, and as the Gemara says, the guy will be punished as well. And if nothing happened, if there was no guilt, then she isn't going to get hurt, just the opposite. She receives certain blessings that are outlined in the Torah, right? That's the mitzvah of Sota. Like it, don't like it, that's the mitzvah of Sota. Take a look at source number 5, where we find the code of Hammurabi. If a man bring a charge against one's wife, but she is not surprised with another man, A man alleges that his wife was involved with somebody, but she's not caught with this guy. She must take an oath and then may return to her house. She swears to her innocence and then she goes home. If the finger is pointed at a man's wife about another man, but she is not caught sleeping with the other man. So they weren't caught in the act. However, there was something apparently to go on. This finger is pointed. She shall jump into the river for her husband. That doesn't mean jump into the river like go swimming. It means she's thrown into the river, trial by ordeal. Right? It means you throw her in the river, and if she survives, then that means she's innocent. Taken in that light, I'm not the one to invent this idea, but I don't remember where I saw it first. The sota is essentially a response to that. Instead of the Hammurabi system, which assumes guilt and requires a miracle that saves her from the water in order to prove innocence, the Torah system says we assume innocence and only of the miracle would she be punished, would she suffer. Normally you drink water that has a little bit of ink erased into it, nothing happens to you. We assume innocence and it would require a miracle to prove guilt, number one, and number two, instead of throwing her into the water, she takes the water into her. She drinks the water. So this may be read as a response to Hammurabi. You see it in terms of mitzvos. You also see it in terms of the Torah's philosophy. When we learned Iyov, when we spent those 2 years on Iyov, in the beginning of the process, we looked at other texts that were contemporary to, or alleged to be contemporary anyway, it's hard to know exactly when Iyov was written, but are alleged to be contemporary to Iyov, that secular scholars say Iyov is very similar to, but when you start reading them, you realize they're not similar at all. And my favorite example is source number 6, Sumerian work, Man and His God, which tells us, first comes a brief introductory exhortation in this book, Man and His God, that man should praise and exalt his God and soothe him with lamentations. The poet then introduces the unnamed individual who, upon being smitten with sickness and misfortune, addresses his God with tears and prayers. There follows the sufferer's petition, which constitutes the major part of the poem. It begins with a description of the ill treatment accorded him by his fellow men, friend and foe alike, continues with a lament against his bitter fate, including a rhetorical request to his kin and to the professional singers to do likewise, and concludes with a confession of guilt and a direct plea for relief and deliverance. Finally comes the happy ending, in which the poet informs us the man's prayer did not go unheeded, and that his God accepted the entreaties and delivered him from his afflictions. All this leads, of course, to a further glorification of his God. I can't imagine a book that has less of a resemblance to Iyov than this. Right? I mean, you don't have the visitors who are arguing with him, which is the bulk of the book. In this book, this Sumerian book, he apologizes and he confesses his guilt and pleads for relief. Like, that's not in Iyov. I see Iyov as a response to this, as a response to that kind of literature, giving a very different approach to it. And finally, most controversially, but I mention it because I couldn't not mention it, the story of the Mabul. You are probably familiar with the Gilgamesh epic, which people point out is a story of a flood that seems to have similarities to it. So Rabbi Joel Wolowelski, in the journal Tradition, in an article called A Note on the Flood Story in the Language of Man, he talks about the concept of Dibra Torah Kalashon Bnei Adam, that the Torah speaks in human forms, in human modes. So he says, is the Gilgamesh epic of any relevance to the Torah student? The point-by-point concordance between the Gilgamesh epic and the biblical flood story is either deliberate or purely coincidental. And the degree of agreement makes the latter untenable. You can't tell me it's a coincidence, he says. On the simplest level, the Torah's account of the flood is part of its campaign against the pagan culture of the time. Despite the point-by-point convergence between the two stories, The differences between them are much more paramount and significant, as many have pointed out, and need not be repeated here. So he's not going to go through, he's not giving you the whole discussion. For that, you can look around, there are plenty of articles about it. But his point is to say that the Mabul is meant, in the way that it is presented in the Torah, as a way to respond to philosophies found in Gilgamesh. Now, is he alleging that the Mabul never happened? Not necessarily. But that's why this story, that's why this point of view is controversial. Because of the question of what exactly are you saying about the events of the Mabul. But I bring you this in order to say, maybe Mishlei is like that. Maybe Mishlei is meant to present, here is our view of the pursuit of Chochma, wisdom, and a proper midos, proper attributes. Perhaps Shlomo is expressing ideas that are found elsewhere. Mesopotamia, Egypt, wherever. But he adds and he alters them in ways that will convey divine wisdom as well as Torah. So he has a focus on God, his associations of Chochmah and Yiras Hashem, reverence for God. He argues against the idolatrous elements that are found in wisdom literature and other cultures. He takes out those pieces and he argues against them. And in addition to that, he uses the superlative divine wisdom that he has been given. So you have very intricate poetry in his Mishalim and in his Shirim, in his poems, which we're going to see the Vilna Gaon and the Malbim spend a lot of time unpacking. He incorporates deeper messages that are beyond the superficial. And again, we're going to see the commentators spend time unpacking them. And I come back to my speculation that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. The Eitz Hada'as Tov Vara, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I feel like he is giving us the Eitz Hada'as Tov. He's giving us the tree of life, the tree of knowledge of good, in order to take us away from the bad side of it, which he doesn't want you to go for, the wisdom that's emerging from other societies. That's my thought, is that this is the Torah's response to a body of wisdom literature that is out there. I got a thumbs up from Ricky. Okay. Questions and comments. I hope this recorder is working. The screen is blank. I don't want to record this again. Yes, Rose and then Susan.
So, I just have a question. The Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
It's a poem. Isn't it a poem?
Yeah. It's an epic.
It's an epic.
Epic poem.
But so, how can you put it parallel to this?
Not to Mishlei, parallel to Noach.
No, to the Mabul. Why is it?
Oh, because if you look at the contents do have strong similarities.
Oh, okay.
I mean, many have argued that there was a historic Mabul, and the Gilgamesh epic was some society's attempt to, to record the story. I'm not enough of a Gilgamesh scholar to really tackle that. Yeah, Susan.
When you brought up from the Talmud about the things you can't read.
Yeah.
But Rambam read a lot of science and stuff. I mean, for now, what is legal to read? I don't know what word.
Yeah, so this is a bigger topic. I gave a shiur a while back, which is on YU Torah, and maybe I'll send a link for it.
Okay.
The Torah has a mitzvah, v'lo sasur achrei levavchem v'achrei einechem. You shall not stray after your heart and your eyes. And the Gemara on that says, straying after your eyes refers to immorality, being lured by what one sees. Straying after your heart is being lured into idolatry. And one is not supposed to do things or read things or expose themselves to things that could lead them in that direction. So the Rambam has a very interesting distinction. When it comes to things that are not idolatrous, but on the other hand, they could lure a person away from God and commitment to God and Torah. So the Rambam says in his Hilchos Avodah Zarah, his laws of idolatry, he says, you can read those things after you have gotten a solid fill of Torah. Mile kreso babasar v'yayin, something along those lines is his expression. You have to fill your gut with meat and wine, meaning you have to know enough Torah in order to be anchored in that and stable in that and to know what the Torah has to say.
Sounds like the Zohar. Like,
on the other hand, and there's a reason for the Zohar Association, but I'm not going there right now. But yes, you are correct. On the other hand, if it leads to idolatry, the Rambam doesn't want you to learn it ever. That which involves the worship of other, other religions, Rambam doesn't want you going there at all. There's a lot to be said, and I'm going to send out Bli Neder the link to that shiur so that you can hear that, because it's a longer topic than I can do justice to here. So
that would make a great Wednesday topic.
Yeah, maybe it would. Maybe it would. Okay, other questions and comments? Okay. Sandra, I'm so glad I can see you. Last week I was wondering who RSB was. I know someone who is RSB, but I didn't think he was here. Okay. So that's addressing our second question that we asked in the beginning of the class, right? We wanted to know, so who wrote this book? And what's the deal with Amenemope? That was our second question. But now we're ready to go back to our first opening question, which was, what do we do with Mishle's apparently simplistic view of the world? And we have two problems. Problem number one is its promises of reward and punishment. Do good things, you'll get rewarded. Do bad things, you'll get zapped. And problem number two, the basic nature of the advice, when you read this book on a straightforward level, you look at it and say, well, this could be anybody's wisdom literature, which of course we've already started to address now. But take a look at your sheet, at source number 8, and use it as a reference for Mishle. Going to the issue of reward and punishment in the book, I just did a fast survey of chapter 3. The very beginning of chapter 3, sentences 1 and 2. Mishle says, Bini, Tarasi al tishkach, my son, don't forget my Torah. Umitzvosai yitzor li becha, your heart should guard my mitzvos. Ki orech yamim ushnos chayim v'shalom yosifu lach. If you fulfill the mitzvos, you will have a long life, you will have shalom, you will have peace. Amazing. No? That's the formula. If you take a look at the same chapter, sentence 9, the kabed es Hashem mehonecha, honor God from your wealth. Umei reishis kol tibuasecha, and from the first of all of your produce. You know what will happen if you do that? Your granaries will be full. And the wine in your wine press will burst forth. You want to have grain? You want to have wine? No problem. Use from your wealth to honor God. Bring the bikurim, the first fruits, and that's your solution. Jump to the end of the chapter, sentences 33, 34. When it comes to the fate of the wicked, Me'eras Hashem beveis rasha, the curse of God afflicts the house of the wicked. Unuveit tzadikim yivarech, but God will bless the home of the righteous. Im laleitzim hu yalitz, this is a well-known pasuk. For the scorners, those who mock, God will mock them. V'la anavim yiten chen, and for those who are humble, God will give them chen, a word without a good translation. But God will treat them well. So this book says, you do good things, you get good. You do bad things, you get bad. How many people have ever witnessed anything like it? Now, I have to note here, and I did it in source number 9, that I think this question, which a lot of people ask, is a little overblown. In the sense that Mishlei chapter 13, sentence 23, which we will flip to now, is very clear in its understanding that sometimes crime pays. No, Rose, you're going to have to wait. Chapter 13, sentence 23. The Rav Ochel Nir Rashim, that's the first half. I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on the second half. V'yesh nisped below mishpat. There are some people who in fact are destroyed unjustly. So Mishlei itself does acknowledge that. The ratio is still heavily towards the side of do good things, you get good. But the acknowledgement is there, number one. And number two, since we work from a Tanakh and not only from a Sefer Mishlei, Koheles, chapter 11, sentence 1. If there is a cynical book in Tanakh, it is Koheles. Koheles, more than Eov, much more than Eov, is a cynic's paradise. Which is maybe a little oxymoronic, but whatever. If you take a look at Koheles, which is right after ours in Tanakh, chapter 11, sentence 1, look what he says. Shalach lach mecha al pnei hamayim, ki verov hayamim timtza'enu. Send your bread off across the waters, and over time you will find it, which we understand to mean if you give your money, if you support others, if you give tzedakah, you will be repaid. That's the cynic who is saying that. Now, the truth is Koheles has cycles of belief and doubt and problems and so on. We have to learn more about that when we get to Koheles. But my point is only to say, don't hang your hat too much on this question of Mishlei seems so simplistic. Mishlei is not as simplistic as it's played out to be. And other books also talk about this kind of faith. But that's one challenge that's brought. The other challenge is, the advice really does seem, again, reading it superficially, very basic. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 10. We're going back into Mishlei now, and I gave you a bunch of references. Chapter 11, sentence 20. Tovas Hashem ikshelev. Urtzono tmimei derech. God doesn't like crooked people. God likes people who follow an innocent path. Did I need to open a book in order to know that? I think I knew that. Chapter 15, sentence 1. Ma'ane rach yashiv chema. A soft response will settle anger. Udvar etzev. Yala af. Whereas if you speak in anger, that's going to increase the rage. Someone yells at you, you respond softly, you have a chance. You respond with anger, that's just adding fuel to the fire. It's true, but again, did I need Tanakh to teach me that? One more. Chapter 21, sentence 13. Otem ozno miza'akas dal. One who blocks his ear from hearing the cry of the needy, gam hu yikra v'lo ye'aneh. When he cries out, he isn't going to be answered. Okay. I mean, again, is that chokhmah? Is that divine wisdom? But again, hang in there, Ricky. I'm going to take questions and comments in a minute. But I just wanted to show you, this question could really be also considered overblown. And I point you to source number 11 on your sheet, which I did not translate myself. I pulled it from Sefaria, Rabbi Yosef Sabag. This is a classic. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato wrote the Musar work, Mesilas Yesharim, The Path of the Just. It's a book of advice on how to grow to greater levels of piety and purity. And in the beginning of the book, he says, well, you'll see what he says, because I want to read it. I'm going to read out his English translation, but I gave you the original Hebrew there as well. He said, I have composed this work, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato says, I have composed this work not to teach people what they do not know, but to remind them of what they already know, and which is very familiar to them. For you will find in most of my words only things which most people already know and do not have any doubt about. But according to their familiarity and to the extent that their truth is evident to all, so too is their neglect very prevalent and forgetfulness of them very great. Everybody knows them and they ignore it and they forget it. Therefore, the benefit to be gleaned from this book is not from a single reading, For it is possible that the reader will learn little that he didn't already know. The point is not just exposure to it, you know it already. Rather, the benefit derived from this book comes from review and diligent study. For then he will be reminded of these things which by nature people tend to forget. And he will put to heart his duties which he hides from. If you reflect on the current state of affairs in most of the world, you will see most people of quick intelligence and sharp mentality devote most of their thought and interest in the subtleties of wisdom, the depths of analysis. But few are those which devote thought and study to the matter of perfection of divine service, on love, fear, clinging, and the other branches of piety. This is not because they don't consider these things as fundamental. For if you ask them, each one will answer you, this is of utmost importance. It is unimaginable for one to be considered truly wise if he has not fully comprehended these matters. Rather, their lack of devoting more attention to it stems from its being so familiar and so evident to them that they see no need for spending much time on it. Consequently, this study and the reading of books of this sort is left to people of not so keen, almost dull intelligence. These types of people you will find diligent in all this, not budging from it until the situation has reached the point that if one sees a person engaging in piety, he cannot help but suspecting him of belonging to those of dull intelligence, right? When you see people who spend their time learning Musar, learning ethical instruction, you think, ah, yeah, it's too bad. He's not a rocket scientist, so all right, he'll learn this instead. You see two people, one of them is sitting over a Gemara, and the other one is learning Pirkei Avos, and the assumption is the Gemara guy has a head for Gemara, and the Pirkei Avos guy doesn't. And he says, that's really too bad. That's not the way it ought to be. The consequences of this situation are very evil, both for those who possess wisdom and those who do not. For it causes both types to lack true piety, thereby making it exceedingly rare to be found anywhere in the world. It is absent from the wise due to their insufficient reflection on it, and likewise to the non-wise due to their insufficient grasp of it. He says, the ones who could really understand the Musar aren't learning it. The ones who can't understand it aren't going to get anything out of it anyway. The situation has reached the point where most people imagine piety consists of reciting many psalms, very long confessions, difficult fasts, immersions in ice water and snow. All are things incompatible with intellect and which reason cannot find peace. That was Rabbi Luzzatto's opening for his book of ethical guidance. And to me, if I was just faced with this question of why does Mishlei have such basic advice, I would just answer you, because people need books of basic advice, and they should spend time on them. It's a good idea. Okay, questions, comments, answers to our two questions. Number one, about the simplistic character of its reward and punishment view. Number two, about its basic nature of the advice, before we go to two answers that I can give. Whose hand was up? Ricky.
I always had trouble with the reward and punishment. I think it sets up unrealistic expectations. I know my late husband refused to believe in God and to observe because his little brother was murdered. I don't mean annihilated, I mean murdered by the Nazis. You have people, when you hear of all the Chazal, the biggest, most pious, most learned people who died, and we learn about them, starting with Rabbi Akiva himself. And you say to yourself, if the big trees are going to catch on fire, what chance do I have? So when you're reading this and it says, yes, I will be pious, I'll be doing something. Yeah, but look at some of the people who were punished, even though they were far more pious than I am, than I could ever be. So I think it sets unreasonable expectation. I sat beside a woman in a luncheon, and when we said Birkat HaMazon, when we got to the part, "Velo ra'iti tzadik mevakesh," she just said, "Oh, I did."
Yeah, I was actually going to get to that verse, although we're not going to get to it today. But I was going to bring that in because it fits with my second my second approach. But I hear you. It is a turnoff for people whose experience doesn't match it when they see this. Which, again, just builds the question. So what is this doing here? You can't tell me that Shlomo was unaware of the line which He actually has in chapter 13. Yesh nisfeh belo mishpat. There are those who are destroyed unjustly. He knows that. So what is this? What is this book doing here? Susan.
No, I'm sorry. Could you just talk a little bit more about this?
Oh, no, I am going to. That's where we're going.
I'm sorry?
We're going there. You'll see. Yes, Susan.
Oh, now she made it loose between.
Okay. Sorry. Ricky does that to me also sometimes.
That's why the book was written when bad things happen to good people.
I'm not getting on to that topic. I can't say anything regarding the author who endured something horrific and awful, but I don't agree with his philosophy either. So I'm just going to leave that one. But it is why the book was written, because people have the problem. In that sense, yes.
I was going to say the simplistic, everybody's worried today. I'm in a book club, and everybody's worried it has to be deep. It has to be deep. We can't read a book that's not deep. And you know what? I don't think that's necessarily true. Sometimes you read the simple things, besides the fact of what those authors says, and it gives you a shake. Sometimes you read the simple things and you know that, hey, that's a way to live that's easy enough to do.
Right.
I don't always have to look for the tenth meaning on the dot of it. Just having it there.
Yeah.
That's something I can handle. I don't have to read Rashi necessarily or six commentators to get it. I can read this book. Yes, there are commentaries to all of them. But I can read this book and walk out with something without it and not be confused. I can pick up something and enjoy it. And I think we've forgotten that there's nothing wrong with simplicity and what you can learn from it.
Right. I think the word you're looking for is wholesome.
Okay.
You know, there's something, it isn't bad to have something that's just wholesome, that doesn't, you know, fry my brain. You know, that's what I'm hearing you saying.
I can read Mishle, and I remember taking it at school years ago, but I can read it today and say, okay, I don't remember what Rabbi Sponso said about, but I got something out of this today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the thing. You can always walk away from a book that you understand with something.
Right. Agreed. Janine, you were going to say?
I just want to say that a book that isn't about why good things happen to bad people is Eov. I think the answer is the end. We're not meant to understand everything.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, Eov is, you know, an attempt to try to help us see and understand. Not understand, that's the wrong word, but see and come to terms with what it is that we're seeing. Agreed. And I'm going to actually come back to that, although I'm not sure I'm going to get to that today, because that's going to fit into my second approach. Stay tuned. Let's do the first approach. The first approach is, this book is meant as instructions for the young. That's an approach also. And this goes back to a source that I brought you when we started the series. I reproduced it in source number 12. Right, Moshe Lichtenstein, in his essay on Tanakh study, Fear of God, the Beginning of Wisdom and the End of Tanakh Study. End not meaning final, end meaning goal of Tanakh study. Let us now return to Tanakh and utilize these metaphors and analogies as a guide to assist us in determining our approach to Tanakh, the things that he talked about before this point in his essay. You don't know what his metaphors and analogies are because I didn't bring those. The first conclusion to be drawn is that there must be age differentiation. The child should receive a version of the Torah that appeals to his imagination and understanding, even at the expense of depth and sophistication. It will therefore be a more vivid and less introspective approach that may often be two-dimensional and schematic, with the emphasis upon action rather than reflection. In addition, it will prefer amplification over ambiguity, literal comprehension over textual analysis. Thus, Rashi, who is a quintessential amplifier, he explains what that means now, will consistently portray the, quote, heroes in a more positive light than the psukim, the verses themselves, thereby making the good guys better, while the villains are usually cast in a more negative light that will always make the bad guys seem worse. It is a didactic world of black and white that does its best to eliminate gray from its universe, and therefore most appropriate for the child's needs. Now, that isn't Mishlei, that's overall, but then in the footnote he addresses Mishlei. Footnote 11, he says, an enlightening example from Tanakh itself is the interplay between, there you go, Janine, I forgot it was also in this one, between Mishlei and Iyov. Both address the issue of divine justice, but in markedly different perspectives. Mishlei presents a conventional, almost facile, morality that portrays a world in which the righteous are always rewarded and the wicked never prosper. The outlook of the companions that Sefer Iyov so unflinchingly attacks is the very world that Mishlei champions, right? The three visitors who get you know, dissed in Iyov for saying to Iyov that if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong and all of that, they're the heroes in Mishlei. The juxtaposition of the two, putting them side by side in Tanakh, right? Susan, you asked about them being, you know, with the books around it in Tanakh. The juxtaposition of the two is almost an act of self-reflection on the part of Tanakh, with Iyov serving to call into question the conclusions of its companion Sefer. One of the more plausible suggestions to explain the discrepancy is that Mishlei is addressed to the young child, while Iyov reflects the world of the adult. The voice of the narrator in Mishlei is the didactic parental voice, while Iyov presents the raging debate of the embittered adult conversing with his peers. Each message is age-appropriate for the needs of its participants. That's the approach that Moshe Lichtenstein likes over here. And I told you last week, I listened to a recorded lesson by Rabbi Chaim Angel, and he attributed the same idea to Rabbi Shalom Carmi, who's a very significant thinker, philosophy and Tanakh, literature. My friend who was with us in the Beit Midrash, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering, did an introduction for Mishlei when we did Tanakh in a day, and we did half an hour on each sefer in Tanakh. And he likes this idea as well. And it fits source number 13. Professor Avigdor Hurwitz, who we've talked about and quoted off and on, says that the contents of the book suit a school environment, and he has an interesting note. He says, in source number 13, Miskirazu, from this survey, Yotzei Shekolachan Mishivas HaKvatzim Al Korachi Vayam HaShonim, he says, each of the seven units in the book, with all their different components, he is of the belief that you can break it into seven units. We talked about that in the second week of the series. He says, each of these seven units he says, each of them finds their workshop, so to speak, the place where they are crafted, and the place where they are at home, in the communal environment of the school. Specifically, a school for children of privilege who are going to grow up to be political leaders. He's envisioning Shlomo, right? Not Shlomo per se. Avigdor Hurwitz is not necessarily buying into Shlomo's authorship necessarily. But his point is to say, this is like what you would teach children who are going to grow up to lead. Kolkovetz ponel etzarech intellektuali shoneh. Each unit focuses on a different intellectual purpose. Umiatzeg shita didaktit mishalo, and expresses its own didactic approach. V'chulam yachad yicholum l'shamesh v'sefer limud shalem, and together they become a complete textbook. So that's one school of thought, is that this is actually meant to be for children. Why shouldn't children have a book in Tanakh that's meant to be for their instruction? In a variation on that, you could suggest that it's a book for teachers, right? It's a book for parents. It's a book for grandparents. It's a good book for teachers to tell them how to teach children. The book Amenemope, this wisdom of Amenemope that we talked about, take a look at source 14 from John Ruffel's article. The Turin Writing Board preserves the bulk of chapters 24 and 26. He's talking about different editions that are found of that book. With only one exception, follows exactly the same line division as the BM text, which is another one they have. It is interesting that as well as preserving these divisions, there are marginal signs reading day 4, day 8, day 10, day 12, day 18, irregularly spaced but possibly indicating set portions for a pupil's study. Now, we have within Tehillim the idea of days for reciting different parts. I don't know how that fits. But the idea could be that the book is meant for a textbook for teachers. If you take a look at source number 15, I noted something that we saw a few weeks ago. When the Vilna Gaon comments on the beginning of the book, when we were talking about the messages of Mishlei and the message of acquiring Chochmah, so we said that in chapter 1, sentence 4, the book says, I'll read out the actual verse. I'm not remembering it word for word. After it says that this book is for the reader to acquire wisdom and insight and righteousness and so on, it then says, Laseis lifsayim arma, to give to the fools cleverness. Linar, to give to the youth, das umezima, wisdom, strategy, cunning, however you want to translate mezima, we talked about. So the Vilna Gaon says, in source number 15, Laseis, to give. Once he learns, and he knows, and he fulfills, then he can teach others. So it's for you to learn in order to teach. The book is addressed to a teacher. So that's one approach. It's for kids, whether directly or whether via the teacher. The other approach that I would give, though, and this, you know, echoes what we saw in Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in his Mesilas Yesharim, is that everybody can benefit from emuna, from faith. And everybody can benefit from simple advice. As far as the simple advice, the text in Mishlei does offer some depth, according to our commentators. And what I'm going to show you, and I'm looking at the time and realizing I'm going to have to show this to you next time, is we looked at chapter 21, sentence 13. And we said, oh, that sentence, that's so simplistic. Anybody could have said that. There's nothing special about that. What we're going to do is we're going to come back to chapter 21, sentence 13, and read it with the explanations of Rabbi Menachem Meiri, of the Vilna Gaon, of the Malbim, and you will start to see layer upon layer in it. And then we're going to have to also discuss the simplicity of the emunah, the faith that's described there, and hopefully get to some understanding of why this is valuable as well. So we're going to come back to this, God willing, next week, and then we have a few side notes to wrap up in our introduction, and then we'll spend some time studying particular sections from Mishlei. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. I hope this recording took. We'll find out.
Well, I won't be there on Thursday. I can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Everything all right?
Me too, but, yeah.
Okay.
Feel better, Rabbi.
Thank you.
I was just...